From the headquarters of Swinnerton, this is the Modern Built Environment Podcast, featuring exclusive interviews with world-class thought leaders, executives, and civic leaders committed to a better and more beautiful built environment. Established in 1888 and built on a foundation of integrity, trust, and collaboration, our history has prepared us for this moment. Possibility is limited only by our imagination. We know what tomorrow can bring because we've seen thousands of tomorrows and are prepared to shape what comes next. Pride of ownership, peace of mind. Our podcast is hosted by Tom DiOro of The Modern Architect at KZSU at Stanford University. Go to swinnerton.com/podcast.
Thank you, Maggie. For our guest today, please welcome Kimberly Dowdell, architect and Director of Business Development at HOK, as well as the 2020 National President of the National Organization of Minority Architects, NOMA. Kim holds a Harvard University Master of Public Administration, as well as a Bachelor of Architecture at Cornell University. Kim also won the 2020 AIA Young Architects Award, honoring individuals who have demonstrated exceptional leadership and made significant contributions to the architecture profession early in their careers. For more information, feel free to visit noma.net. Again, noma.net. Hello, Kim. Welcome to the Modern Built Environment Show. Thank you so much. I'm honored to have you today.
Hello, Tom. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me to join you.
Now, Kim, as we talked before our show, we like to start off with, you know, a meaningful quote. And if you'd be at liberty to share with us a meaningful quote or mantra, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think about Toni Morrison a good amount, given that she had so many wonderful things to share with the world in her writing and philosophy. And she actually just passed away about a year ago. And in 2003, she had an interview with the Oprah magazine. And she said, "I tell my students, when you get these jobs that you've been so brilliantly trained for, just remember that your real job is that if you are free, you need to free somebody else. If you have some power, then your job is to empower somebody else. This is not just a grab bag candy game." Awesome. And I thought that was so powerful because, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected. And I think that if more people, you know, kind of really understood that and took that in as, you know, some level of almost like a call to action when you're privileged with certain opportunities, like, you know, I had many educational opportunities growing up. You know, I think it's important that we give back to those who are, you know, trying to find their way in the world. That quote really resonated with me, especially, you know, in terms of the advocacy that NOMA is looking to do for young people in particular. So that's why I chose that particular quote.
We've known each other for a while now, but I feel like you go out of the house giving and contributing. Oh, is that just part of who you are as a person or as an architect as well?
You know, I have to credit my grandmother for a lot of the sensibilities that I have relative to kind of giving. You know, she was alive for the first 31 years of my life, and I was just very deeply impacted by the example that she set. So when I was born, she'd already retired, but she was a part of the Retired Senior Volunteer Program. And so she actually volunteered for 37 years at the Children's Hospital of Michigan. So this is like post-retirement. She lived to be 99 and a half years old. And so like her involvement with Children's Hospital and with her church and several other, you know, efforts, just growing up and seeing that, it really, you know, really stuck with me. So I think that contributes a lot to what I'm trying to do in the world, making it better.
Yeah, making it better all the time. So that inspiration, obviously, you carry with you. What is a, you know, change in architecture since, I guess we want to say post-COVID, that you can share with us if you're at liberty to share?
Well, I feel like we're not necessarily post.
We're not really. So that
I guess, right, we're in the kind of the eye of the storm right now. But one of the things that, you know, I do hope that we'll see change, you know, as we, you know, become more accustomed to this new way of life, and, you know, hopefully some parts of what used to be our normal come back. But certainly, I think new things need to, you know, to evolve. But I think that the emphasis on addressing health disparities has become very clear. You know, looking at the disparities in particularly communities of color, I think has been really sobering. You know, just the notion that whatever zip code you live in might actually have a pretty drastic impact on your chances of contracting the virus and unfortunately passing away. So, you know, earlier on in the virus, we learned that states like Illinois, where I live now, or Michigan, where I'm from, have similar percentages of African-American, which is around 14% of the population of those states. But 40% of the COVID deaths were in the African-American community. That's a huge disparity. And there are a lot of things that factor into that. But I think in terms of, you know, what we can do in architecture is there's more attention that can be paid to, you know, public space and density. And actually beyond architecture, there's housing policy and economic policies and things of that nature. But, you know, the duty of an architect is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. And I think that, you know, COVID has really been a magnifying glass on the inequities that we're seeing in our society. And then that coupled with, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement and, you know, just the tragic killing of George Floyd. I mean, it's been a great awakening moment for our country. And so I think that everyone is looking to see, you know, how they can contribute to closing some of the, you know, these gaps that we're seeing in terms of health and also, you know, educational achievement and wealth and things of that nature. So we're looking at almost a reboot of the civil rights movement, a refresh of the Great Depression, and also the Spanish flu. So a lot has happened in the last 100 days, and we're all trying to navigate it together.
Yeah. How has your training as an architect helped improve a lot of those situations even now? I know it's rather sudden to say, oh, here's what we're doing, but can you share with us some examples that you're a part of, which with NOMA and HOK, that you're actually helping, which I know you are, but I'd love to hear your
experiences. Sure. So, I mean, one of the amazing things about the training of an architect is, you know, we're natural problem solvers. You know, when we're given a design brief by our professors when we're in school, you know, we spend several weeks or the whole semester solving the problem that's given to us by our professors. And one of the things that you learn very early on in architecture school is that design is an iterative process. So you try something and then you see if it works, you test it out, you try it again, you keep designing until you get to the right solution. And, you know, I think that in terms of what we're doing on the HOK side relative to the virus is, you know, working closely with our corporate interiors clients to help them think through, you know, how to modify their workspace so that when people do come back to the office, the proper social, or I like to call it physical distancing, is put in place, and that, you know, there are clear markers for where people, you know, can and should be standing and thinking about, you know, hand sanitizing stations and, you know, things of that nature to really promote the kinds of spacing that's going to be required to make people feel comfortable going back into the workplace. And then on the NOMA side, you know, one very, very clear example of us, you know, having to iterate and to be adaptive is NOMA actually launched the new initiative actually before this virus even kicked off. But so, earlier in the introduction, you mentioned I'm the 2020 national president of NOMA. I'm actually the 2019 and 2020 president, which means, yeah, sure.
Thank
which means I have two full years of leadership, which has been a lot, especially the last 100 days. But because we first met when I first became president early last mm-hmm. year. And so around that time, so about almost a year and a half ago now, NOMA decided that we were going to take a stronger stance on getting our young people, once they graduate, into internship opportunities with firms so that essentially wouldn't lose them in the profession, because oftentimes students will graduate and then if they don't find the exact right job, at, you know, squarely within architecture, they might go into construction or real estate or, you know, work for an engineering firm or just, you know, kind of go off the traditional architecture path, which is okay, but we still need as many people who studied architecture to stay in the profession. And so we created a program called the NOMA Foundation Fellowship to essentially help our students or new graduates build a strong foundation on which to build their careers. And really, this was inspired in part by the UDream program out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a number of years ago now, but that program lost its funding. And, you know, essentially it was geared towards attracting, you know, minority students to Pittsburgh and to study, they'd already studied architecture, but connecting them with internship opportunities. And so what we decided to do was actually utilize the, you know, a version of that concept, but actually make it nationwide. And so getting, you know, firms that have expressed interest in increasing their diversity matched with students or, you know, those who are graduating with those firms so that they could actually, you know, start, you know, a 12-week internship get paid to do that work and then decide if they want to work with that firm. And the firm obviously gets a chance to more squarely recruit them. And when the pandemic hit, you know, understandably, all the firms that we had been in touch with regarding matching with students, they were going through their own staff reductions. They were, you know, having policies that stated that they actually couldn't bring in new interns. So we actually reformatted the whole program, you know, once we realized that we actually needed to work even harder to make sure that these students had opportunity. Because otherwise, there are literally like very few jobs floating around for people who just graduated. And even the jobs that existed before are kind of shrinking just due to lower activity in the marketplace. So what we did was we actually got $50,000 from the AIA Large Firm Roundtable, which represents the 60 largest firms in North America. So their CEOs get together, you know, several times a year to actually talk through the biggest issues in the profession. And one of the issues that, you know, everyone agrees is, you know, very important is diversity in the profession. So they invested $50,000 with NOMA over the next 5 years. So it's a total of $250,000. That started last year, actually. And so we, at this point, have collected $100,000. And what we've decided to do is actually pay, you know, for these students or new graduates to work for firms, some of them larger roundtable firms, some of them mid-sized firms or smaller firms, to make sure that they have access to opportunity. So we're calling it, to some extent, like the NOMA stimulus check. Just, you know, it's $2,000 per, you know, per young person, per fellow, I should say, to actually make sure that they have, you know, money to kind of pay for things that they need to pay for and keep them connected to the profession. And certainly we would look to the firms to further support them. But, you know, this is about making sure we hang on to folks, because during the last recession, our profession lost, you know, a whole generation of people. I mean, there's a huge gap. Those who graduated from 2007 to 2010, 2011, they're, you know, frankly missing from the workforce, at least in architecture. So we're looking to kind of stem that as much as we can with the NOMA Foundation Fellowship Program. So that was directly in response to the virus. And so those are two examples that come to mind right away. But, you know, we're constantly having to just shift our expectations and make sure that we are, you know, meeting the needs of the hour.
Excellent. You're listening to the Modern Built Environment podcast brought to you by Swinnerton. We're talking today with Kim Dedal, architect and director of business development at HOK and the 2019-2020 national president of the National Organization of Minority Architects, NOMA. For more information, feel free to visit noma.net. Again, noma.net. Kim, going back to the, I'll call it the business of architecture, in that you develop and implement strategic business development and marketing initiatives. If you, I don't know if you can quantify a number or percentage, but how important do you feel that the business development is within architecture?
I think business development and marketing are critical to building and maintaining a strong business. One of the things I think set HOK apart very early on when it was founded in 1955 is that it really embraced the four-legged stool of business, particularly business and architecture. So marketing and business development, that's one of the key components. And then the other three are, of course, design, management, and technical expertise. So, you know, you want to make sure that you're bringing in business and building relationships and making sure that the clients that you build relationships with will continue to call you back. And so that's why it's so important that, you know, the design level is very strong. The level of quality of design is, sure, is where it needs to be, that the technical expertise is there so that, you know, the drawings and the way that things are built are of a high quality. And of course, to coordinate all those things, you need strong management. And so those are really the building blocks that, that, you know, turn HOK into such a large and strong international firm with 24 offices globally, 1,800 employees.
Now, that bringing in the business, I'll stay on that for a minute, is that the outreach connection to community is not common with actually pretty much any field, but we'll stay with architecture. How do you reach out to the community? Because I looked on the website, and I've just from my experience, HOK does a lot of work in the communities that they serve. Is that just part of the culture?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that one of the things that attracted me to join HOK back in 2008 was just, you know, how connected it, you know, the firm seemed to be in, well, one, with NOMA. In fact, I was recruited to join HOK at a NOMA conference. So that was one thing. As soon as I joined, actually, I established the annual NOMA Community Service Project, and HOK was the first sponsor for that. In fact, I think they were the only sponsor that first year. And they wrote, I think, a check for like $3,000. But when you're doing your very first service project, it was like, you know, painting and doing some small repairs around a tutoring center in DC. You know, at that point, I was like very young. So I was like, wow, $3,000. This is so much money. You know, we're able to make it, stretch it and do some really great things for that first project. And now NOMA's done, you know, 11 projects around the country. Right before our conference, we typically do a community service project. But anyway, back to HOK. So around that time, a little bit after the first NOMA service project, people who actually came together for the NOMA service project decided that, you know, HOK supports these things, and there are other examples of that throughout the firm. So we actually founded HOK Impact, which is the firm's corporate social responsibility platform, if you will. So so we're actually about to celebrate 10 years of HOK Impact in 2021. And it was, you know, a group of us younger people who decided that we wanted to formalize the work that we were doing, and not just with giving back to communities and, you know, sort of hands-on projects or pro bono projects, but also things like the ACE Mentor Program to help, you know, middle school and high school kids get exposure to architecture, construction, and engineering, which is what ACE stands for, but also just, you know, giving to different causes and things of that nature. So HOK Impact, actually left HOK for a number of years to go to grad school and do some work in real estate and work in public service. But I came back a year ago, and I was really pleased that HOK Impact was still alive and well, and looking forward to working with the core team to help amplify those efforts even more.
Yeah, you definitely more than touched on our current crises. But what is the current crisis and its impact on design and the modern built environment from your perspective?
Given what's happening, I think people are going to need to be more creative around, you know, resource allocation. We, you know, certainly need to be more resilient. And I think that, you know, as we consider, you know, how we're spending money, how we're investing in communities, I think it's clear that more has to happen in under-resourced communities. And so I think that we're going to, as a society and certainly as a profession, you know, look more closely at design opportunities and development opportunities in places that, you know, just aren't typically seen as ideal for investment. And I think there are examples from, you know, the middle of the 20th century, including, you know, basically policies that have shaped the way that, you know, many urban neighborhoods look and feel right now, specifically, you know, redlining and things of that nature. And there's a book called The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein that actually goes into great detail about how different policies, you know, encourage segregation and encourage disinvestment and encourage, you know, resources to leave, you know, one community, perhaps in the heart of a city like Detroit, my hometown, and go to the surrounding suburbs. And that, you know, that has a real impact on, you know, what those places are experiencing today, particularly relative to, you know, just having a higher number of people who are impacted by COVID, for example. And so I think that going forward, we need to look at how those resources can be brought back into neighborhoods so that we can address some of the kind of wealth inequity that we've, you know, been a part of as a society for the last few decades.
As an architect, what are some of your ideas, maybe even projects? I know you're definitely working on it, but I'm curious if to make an under-resourced community an over-resourced community, but
just like regularly resourced, right?
Okay,
just
there.
Like have the resources they need to meet their needs.
Okay. And even exceed. As an architect, what ways do you see or are you practicing to make that happen? I know you are, but I'm curious to find like what programs or initiatives or actions are we taking to help the under-resourced communities become, as you say, at least resourced?
Right. Yeah. No, that's a great question. So in the Chicago office of HOK, actually, I worked on a project with my colleague, Dominic Salpietra, who heads up our planning practice. And we tag teamed on an effort to lead a commercial corridor revitalization study in the Little Village neighborhood of Chicago. And Little Village is a neighborhood that's predominantly Latinx. And, you know, it's one of the most like vibrant communities in Chicago, and a place where, you know, many Mexican American residents live. And, you know, it's very much a place that, you know, reflects a very strong cultural heritage. But the resources along the commercial corridor are not, you know, quite what they should be. And so the corridor study that we did included, you know, actually sitting down with the Little Village Chamber of Commerce and bringing together, and we actually leaned on them to bring together, you know, the various stakeholders who are business owners, community members, youth, you know, older residents, to talk about, you know, what are some of the things that are missing from their community. So I think the first thing is actually engaging community. There's a saying that nothing about us without us is for us. And I think that's a really important notion when you're looking at helping to support the growth and development of a neighborhood, to actually engage the people who, you know, are really the stakeholders. So we did that community engagement work, and then, you know, brought back a lot of the challenges that we understood from those discussions, and came back with a set of strategies that, you know, we hope that they'll deploy to actually, you know, help the businesses along the corridor and, you know, strengthen the economic conditions throughout the neighborhood. So that's one brief example of how we can engage as designers to actually help meet some of the needs of our currently under-resourced communities.
Super. You're listening to the Modern Built Environment podcast presented by Swinnerton. We're going to provide a public service announcement for Ingenuity. Ingenuity's mission is to ensure that every student in every grade in every school has access to the arts as a part of a well-rounded education. As Chicago's leader in arts education, Ingenuity focuses on four primary strategies: data and research, professional learning, advocacy, and Creative Schools Fund. For more information, you can visit their website at ingenuity-inc.org. Again, ingenuity-inc.org. We're talking today with Kim Dowdell, Architect and Director of Business Development at HOK and the 2019-2020 National President of the National Organization of Minority Architects, NOMA. For more information on NOMA, feel free to visit their website at noma.net. Again, noma.net. Kim, I'm going to go back to the communities again. In addition to how you're helping, can we also keep the heritage and culture alive, if not even enhance it within the community?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's actually a perfect question for how I wanted to actually tie into Ingenuity. Okay. So I moved to Chicago about a year ago, and I met with some of the leadership of Ingenuity very early on, just socially, and they talked about how a big part of what they want to do is provide access to the arts education, or quality arts education, for all Chicago public school students. And I think that's so important to think about how creativity and access to the arts is to developing, you know, not just artists, but also more well-rounded professionals. I mean, I would credit my education in the arts as a, you know, an elementary school student to my exposure to architecture, and hence deciding to become an architect. And I think that, you know, if you want to talk about preserving culture, there's just no better way than, you know, encouraging the arts to flourish in particular neighborhoods. So, you know, anything from the murals to the music that's produced, you know, those are things that, you know, that can really live on, you know, long beyond, you know, the life of the artist even. And so I think creating those legacies through, you know, architecture, through, you know, written word, spoken word, music, painting, things of that nature, is it really just adds to the richness of a particular community. So I can't emphasize enough how important the arts are.
Yes, I agree. Now, policy and architecture, can you share with us a bit of your experience in either helping to change policy, bring awareness to policy in architecture? I'd love to hear some things you've been involved with.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, as an architect who studied public administration, I'm sometimes asked, well, you know, why would you do that? So my response to that is, you know, buildings are so much a part of the public realm, and the way that developers are able to you know, acquire properties and develop properties are really based in policy. And so if we want to shape the future of the built environment, I think it's important that we understand the power that policy has and creating, you know, certain approaches and requirements. So for example, when I worked for the city of Detroit, I worked in the housing and revitalization department, but that department also worked very closely with the planning department. And if a particular property was publicly owned, which many parcels in Detroit are actually owned by the city, so which is somewhat rare for a major city, I would say. But when I was doing that work in 2015, many developers were actually attracted to the city. Many people moved there to develop because of the availability of so much public land. And from the city's perspective, it was important that, you know, we really understood, you know, what would you like to do with the land? You know, what's sort of your long-term plan? Do you have the economic resources to actually, you know, bring that plan to fruition? And then also, what will it look like? You know, physically, we want to understand, you know, the site plan, the architecture that's proposed, you know, what will we get as a city? What will be our return from basically allowing this property to be sold to you? And then the fourth piece was, what does the community have to say? So the community engagement piece was really important. And so without policies that kind of require us to ask those questions and provide for the developer owner to actually respond in ways that, you know, we felt were to the advantage of the city, then, you know, it could have potentially been a free for all where, you know, anyone could buy any piece of land and hold on to it and, you know, be a speculator and prevent progress. And so that's, you know, one example of how policy is really important to protect the interests of the public.
As an architect, well, I'll tell you my opinion of it is I really feel that architects can have a profound and significant impact as a developer. Do you see more of that? Are you involved in that facet where it's not just the developers and then they kind of hire on the architects, but actually the architects have an ownership stake in the actual community?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we should actually see more of that because, you know, having sort of worked in the development space for a number of years, you know, I understand that there's, you know, great risk in development. There's also potentially, you know, there's potential for reward. There's the saying, great risk, great reward. But there's no reason why an architect can't get involved. I mean, the biggest obstacle is really access to capital. Okay. And so the extent to which an architect can gain access to capital and build a team. And I mean, one of the things that architects do naturally is have a vision. And so having a vision for how to develop a property, that sort of comes naturally. But I think it's building the other aspects of the team. That's where I think architects need to partner, you know, with different people with other skill sets. And so I think it's about building a diverse and robust team and gaining access to capital in order to make really great development happen.
Yeah. Access to capital, before we close out here, that's interesting because it seems to have an impact or it's important with all the facets that we've discussed today. The creation of that value, and you just shared with vision that architects naturally have a vision. It's just in their DNA. Can there also be a connection to the community with providing a value so that that access, that capital kind of comes their way? I don't know if I'm phrasing this correctly, but, you know, because it's not as if like, if you give value, which you do, obviously significant, it seems that the capital kind of flows to you. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'd love to hear your take on it.
I mean, I think that the extent to which an architect or developer or team that is interested in improving a place can, you know, show, you know, if I buy this land for X amount and invest Y amount, and then I can extract or you know, create a profit of Z amount, if it makes sense, then I think, you know, that's essentially value creation. But I think it goes beyond that. I think it's about getting the community involved and ensuring that the community is also invested in the future of that project, because I think the most sustainable projects, well, one, the most sustainable building is the one that's already in existence. So I think that particularly in places where there's already existing infrastructure, I think that looking at ways to revive those buildings would be really advisable from a sustainability standpoint, but also potentially it can be economically advantageous. Of course, there are examples where it actually would be better to demolish something and start over, but I think it's a case-by-case basis. But the broader subject is, or I should say the broader message here is, you know, look to create value you know, in anything that you do, but the more support that you can get from, you know, from your community, obviously from the lending community, or, you know, anywhere, or investors, I should say, you know, anywhere where you can actually purchase, help you purchase the land, help you purchase the materials and the people power. I think there's a tremendous opportunity for workforce development in communities that maybe otherwise wouldn't have a ton of access to jobs, but actually creating jobs, creating opportunity is a really valuable thing, particularly in under-resourced communities, so they can become regular resource communities. And so I think that there are lots of ways that development, and so private development, to some extent, the public sector and even the not-for-profit sector can come together. So I really value tri-sector collaboration for some of the most transformative projects. And I think that when you can articulate a clear vision for a community, then, you know, it's a matter of really just building the resources to actualize those plans. And I think that some really beautiful things can happen when, you know, when we all work together towards a common goal, which is, you know, ideally improving the quality of life for people living in certain communities or in cities in general.
Love it. Kim, is there anything that we may not have touched on for your show that you'd like to share with your audience before we commence today?
Well, yeah, thank you for asking the question. One of the things that I hope that people will maybe take a look at when they go to www.noma.net later is taking a look at NOMA's public statement about racial injustice, and specifically look at my call for people to be brave. Brave is an acronym, and you know I won't go into the details there because it's on the website. There's actually a cool Brave graphic on NOMA.net. But essentially, it's about being brave and speaking up. If you see that, you know, there's something unjust happening, you know, speak up. You know, the first letter in Brave is banish racism. So definitely do that, because our society for far too long has been, you know, struggling with that issue. And so I think that, you know, we have far greater things to solve together as a society, like banishing the coronavirus, you know, making sure that people have access to healthy foods and to, you know, eliminate a lot of the disparities that we're seeing relative to health and wealth. So I would just encourage people to treat others as you would want to be treated, as the golden rule, which is actually the last part of the Brave statement. And just be brave. And if you notice that something is not what it should be, speak up.
Excellent. Kim, as always, such a pleasure and honored to have you on our show today. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Modern Built Environment Podcast, brought to you by Swinerton. Find us online at swinerton.com/podcast. Our guest today has been Kimberly Dowdell, Architect and Director of Business Development at HOK, as well as the 2019-2020 National President of the National Organization of Minority Architects, NOMA. Kim won the 2020 AIA Young Architects Award, honoring individuals who have demonstrated exceptional leadership and made significant contributions to the architecture profession early in their careers. For more information, feel free to visit NOMA.net. Again, NOMA.net. Join us again next time when we welcome another leading architect, engineer, builder, manufacturer, or civic leader committed to building a better and more beautiful built environment for healthier cities, communities, and lives. I'm Tom Dioro.
The Modern Built Environment Podcast is recorded at the Swinerton headquarters and on location. The recording engineer is Stephen Blatton. The executive producer and host of the Modern Built Environment Podcast is Tom Dioro. And we're all assisted by Mr. Eric Foster. This is the Modern Built Environment Podcast by Swinerton.